the tie that binds, because you're mine, I walk the line.
Having trouble finding affordable, fresh baked goods and coffee? Come down to Agora Cafe, located in the McMillan Building at UBC. There's also space available to study. I can't stop.
I went to residential school. I was just 8 years old.
Gaila Kasla. My name is Gennarji O'Sullivan of the Tlaweitsis Nation, originally from Turner Island. You're listening to Wendell exploring the legacy of Indian residential schools.
My name is Isabel Francis, and my husband was Louis Francis, who died in 1971. And he went to school in Spanish. My husband was up there till he was 16, and his sister was up there till she was 16. She left 2 years before he did, and he had a younger sister and a younger brother that also went to school up there. He spoke about the conditions up there maybe once or twice, but he never wanted to talk about it. Mm-hmm. Because there were a lot of unpleasant things that were happening to him. He always said, don't ever forget how lucky you are that you were raised by your parents. When he came back at 16, he couldn't talk to his father. His father couldn't speak English and he couldn't speak Mohawk. So there was no togetherness there.
I hear that the mission of residential schools was to, quote-unquote, kill the Indian in the child.
So well, I think they did a pretty good job of that, but to some extent. But I think nobody can do that. I mean, it can't be done, not to make them forget. Look at the First World War, the Second World War, what the Germans and the Japanese did. They couldn't wipe out the good in the people.
His experience up there, would you say it was all bad, or were there...
Well, no. He always said there were some good priests up there. I don't mean to condemn every one of them. Just like in any situation, there's always one that pops out that is against the rules. The only thing I can't forget is that how did the people that were in there get away with something like that? Mm-hmm. One apology doesn't wipe out everything. There are certain things that stand in their mind and that they'll never forget. But that's the way it is now.
Well, thank you, Grandma.
Oh, no problem.
I love you.
I love you too.
You have just heard at Window exploring the legacy of Indian residential schools. Both my mother and I attended St. Michael's Residential School in Alert Bay, BC. This is a part of a larger project called Resonating Reconciliation that engages community radio as a tool to help define what reconciliation is. Resonating Reconciliation is meant to help reconcile all Canadians to this shared history. This is the work of the National Campus and Community Radio Association, the Red Jam Slam Society, and this station. Resonating Reconciliation is also supported by the Indian Residential School Survivor Society and is funded by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. To hear more, go to www.ncra.ca/resonating.
Good morning, good morning. Welcome to Language to Language. Today's a little foggy, but I'm okay. In Haida, I have three names. Kawansanga iskan kitukun iskan kawda hangas hinudikya ang. Tetlanas hat iu de aging. Widow Morrison, Jr. hinu dia art hat i kiltke ang. Di au chayang hinu hat kilt Virginia Cloud hinu maidnim gai laga hidan. Wagyan de hung hansanan Widow Morrison Sr. kyagan is gantla di hat kilt kyagan. Di nan u viola nakatla. Nung hangundals hino di nan kyaang. So in Haida I have three names. Kaunsanga, that's somebody who brings a special day. Kitu kun, the one who stands fast. Hangas, the one who knows when to let go. And then my crest, I'm Tzatlanas, a Haida Tzatlanas. And my crest is eagle with two heads. My English name is Woodrow Morrison Jr. My mother in Tlingit had a Tlingit name, but it was given to my great grandmother, who was half Haida, Chayang, which means the firstborn. Her maiden name was Virginia Cloud. And then my father, Woodrow Morrison Sr., his Haida name was Tla Dai, and his mother, my grandmother, she had actually two names. Slai Towai Kwiwas. Slai is your hands, Towai is oil, and Kwiwas is something precious. So she had precious healing hands, and her other name was Nung Hengundals, a deep sea rolling wave. So Tatskoy, come on in, and we'll play some music and get on to the show. snuck in on this foggy day? Well, for me, it's sort of a transition time. My wife and I rented a suite. Well, she actually moved in there 29 years ago, and I came along and became part of the household 22 years ago. And then one day we got a eviction notice for renovation. Landlord wanted to raise the rent $600 a month. And when you've been living in a place that long and you have to move and you don't want to, it's very emotional. It's very difficult. And I don't know if, you know, this quest for money, I keep seeing it. And I talked to quite a number of people now that have been getting the same thing happening to them. And it seems that this money addiction is growing. From what I heard on the news a couple of days ago, is that Vancouver is the second most non-affordable city in the world. I don't know which one is more unaffordable, maybe Hong Kong, I don't know. But this is number two. And as far as North America, we're the most congested city in all of North America. And when I first came to Vancouver in 1991, I almost never heard of anybody getting shot. But now we've got people shooting each other, cops shooting people shooting cops, and it just seems to be getting worse. In the States, you got children. A young couple left their two-year-old in a car. They were moving, I guess. The child opened a glove compartment. There was a pistol in there. The child took the pistol out and shot itself in the chest, killed itself. Another one was a woman was in Walmart. Her little boy was walking beside her and reached in her handbag and pulled out a pistol and pulled a trigger and killed her. Another one was a lady was changing a diaper on her baby and laid her gun near the baby, and the baby grabbed a hold of it, and it went off and killed the mother. And so you hear all these terrible things going on, and yet we got to buy more guns. And then you listen to Harper. The one thing that maybe he doesn't understand is there's no such thing as a holy war. He talks about how they've declared war on the world, these radical Muslims, or whatever you want to call them. And then he said, especially Canada. Canada's being singled out. He wants that so bad. It's like a person who starts cutting themselves. They can't help themselves, and they got to cut deeper and deeper. And that's what he's doing to Canadian society. Anybody that goes to war has got to have something wrong with them. It has nothing to do with human rights. It's all about trade. It's all about making more money. So nature, I think, is bringing us a little twist to the thing. I don't know how many people have been paying attention to what's happening in the States, but I was listening to the mayor of New York this morning on television, and they're going to be shutting down all their transit system at 6 o'clock this evening because they've got this winter storm coming in, the likes of which they've never seen. It's supposed to be going to be the worst they've ever experienced. They're expecting over a meter of snow, hurricane-force winds. There's going to be lightning and thunder in this snow, and the snow is going to be very dry at first. So when you try to plow it, it's going to be like trying to plow powder. It'll just fill in behind you. So this is going to go up the whole eastern seaboard, all the way up to Connecticut, I think it is. And how do you prepare for something like that? Whereas here on this coast, I'm pretty sure we're going to have the warmest winter on record. I think in Calgary today, was it? The temperature 17 degrees? Somewhere, I heard it on the news this morning. It's somewhere here on the western part of Canada. But with this climate change, all this stuff, all this money people are amassing isn't going to do much good. You can't even burn the stuff. It's so toxic, the fumes would kill you. So how can you warm yourself by burning money? Used to be at least it was made of paper and cloth. Now it's all plastic. So, yeah, so I think nature is throwing a twist into everything. We're dumping stuff in the ocean so fast. Was there something on the news about over in Europe? They're gonna try to make sure that anything you make has to have a 5-year warranty that'll last at least 5 years. The way it is now, like, you go into a dollar store, you can smell all the chemicals in there. I walked into London Drug up here on Broadway and up on Broadway and Vine around there, and it was like walking into one of those dollar stores, the smell of all those chemicals in there. And I go to a post office on Broadway. I walked in, and that place smelled the same. And from what I understand, even the receipts you get have so many chemicals in them. If you're pregnant, you're advised not to handle those receipts because of the chemicals. So where are we going with all that? Anyway, so a little change of temper here, I guess you might say. I found this thing on Facebook, I think it was. Anyway, it's called An Old Man's Poem. When an old man died in a geriatric ward of a nursing home in an Australian country town, it was believed that he'd left nothing of any value. Later, when the nurses were going through his meager possessions, they found this poem called Cranky Old Man. Can you see, nurse? What do you see, nurses? What do you see? What are you thinking when you look at me? A cranky old man, not very wise, uncertain of habit with faraway eyes, who dribbles his food and makes no reply, when you say in a loud voice, I do wish you'd try, who seems not to notice the things that you do, and forever's losing a sock or shoe, who, resisting or not, lets you do as you will, with bathing and feeding, the long day to fill. Is that what you're thinking? Is that what you see? Then open your eyes, nurse. You're not looking at me. I'll tell you who I am as I sit here so still, as I do your bidding, as I eat at your will. I'm a small child of 10 with a father and mother, brothers and sisters who love one another. A young boy of 16 with wings on his feet, dreaming that soon now a lover he'll meet. A groom soon at 20, my heart gives a leap, remembering the vows that I promised to keep. At 25 now, I have young of my own, who need me to guide and secure a happy home. A man of 30, my young now, grown fast, bound to each other with ties that should last. At 40, my young sons have grown and are gone, but my woman is beside me to see I don't mourn. At 50, once more babies play round my knee. Again we know children, my loved one and me. Dark days are upon me. My wife is now dead. I look at the future. I shudder with dread. For my young are all rearing young of their own. And I think of the years and the love I've known. I'm now an old man, and nature is cruel. It's just to make old age look like a fool. The body, it crumbles, grace and vigor depart. There's now a stone where I once had a heart. But inside this old carcass, a young man still dwells, and now and again my battered heart swells. I remember the joy, I remember the pain, and I'm loving and living life all over again. I think for the years, all too few, gone too fast. And accept the stark fact, that nothing can last. So open your eyes, people. Open and see. Not a cranky old man. Look closer. See me. Remember this poem when you meet an older person. You might brush aside without looking at the young soul within. The best and most beautiful things of the world can never be seen or touched. They must be felt by the heart. I like this. I don't know at what time when a person becomes old. Yeah, I'm over 70, but I don't think of myself as old. I don't even think of myself as getting old. I know the years are passing, and I know I'm not as vigorous as I used to be. And I know a lot of young people think that an older person's mind works slower, but it doesn't. There's just so much more stuff in the hard drive to sort through. And nothing has a simple answer. You know, there's not, it isn't like taking a true-false exam at the university. And, you know, universities really bother me. When I was in university, it was a place for discussion where you talked about whatever, issues, whatever. And I walk around the campus here at UBC, and there are almost no discussions. People sitting, texting, with their earphones, listening to music or whatever they're doing. But you don't hear the spoken word. Now, I'm one of these people that really believes in what's called the organic transfer of knowledge, to where you learn from speaking. I've watched people writing essays and whatever. But you can't really discover very much from just writing. You need to sit and talk with somebody and bounce ideas off each other. In 1968, I was released from active duty in the United States Navy in March of 1967. In January of 1968, I went to Fairbanks, Alaska. Man, it was cold there. It was 50 below zero. I was staying at a friend's place, and I used to go to the campus with him. He was trying to talk me into enrolling. But then his friends would come by in the evening, and I'd listen to them talking, philosophy and all these other things. And most of the time I listened because I had no idea what they were talking about. And so I went and enrolled. And my veterans benefits gave me $112 a month. So I went to university, and I enrolled in a course I thought was the history of Western civilization. But what I'd enrolled in was the philosophy of the history of Western civilization. And we had a professor that was an intellectual bully. And see, the one dormitory was all veterans. So we pretty much had our own world to ourselves, and we didn't bother anybody, didn't want anybody to bother us. But anyway, I would ask him questions, and he would put me down. He would make me look like a fool for asking such a stupid question. And I thought, well, I'll try this one other thing. So I went to his office. Professor Hunter, I'm having a hard time. I need some help. And he sort of sneered at me, and he said, if you can't figure out this, maybe you don't belong here. And that was really the wrong thing to say. So I said to him, sir, I'm paying to receive an education at this institution, and you, however, are being paid to help provide me with that information and to assist me in my learning. My learning voyage, I think I might have said. And he said, well, maybe that's true, maybe it isn't. Either figure it out or go someplace else. So I reached across the desk and I grabbed him right in front of it. That's when they still wore suits and ties. I grabbed him by the lapels of his jacket and I pulled him across the desk to me so we were about a hand breadth apart, nose to nose. So I smiled at him and I said, now I'm going to say this in all kindliness. I'm going to ask you if you will help me. And if you say yes and you're just jacking me around, I'm going to do a war dance on your head just for drill. So now are you going to help me? And he didn't say a word, but he was terrified and all he could nod was yes, yes, yes. So I gently returned him to his seat. pulled a chair around next to his, put the book down, said, "Let's begin." And then I laugh about it now, but I can't imagine how terrified that man must have been. You know, he's so used to terrifying everybody else that, you know, cowards are like that. You know, and the, but anyway, we never did become fast friends. But he took the time to answer my questions, and he started treating some of his other students a little better too, because no one had ever called him on it. That's the one thing I've always hated was bullies. And
yeah, Woody, that's a very interesting story. I'm wondering if his approach to teaching changed after that confrontation with you, or how he treated the rest of the class.
Well, I think what happened is he stopped looking at himself in his mental mirror and listening to the sound of his own voice. He started looking at students as though they were people now rather than just objects in a room.
Right.
That he could dictate to. So, yeah, I think it changed his... But, again, I don't really see... Well, one thing I absolutely believe, that the taking of another human life is never justified. You can come up with reasons for it, but it's never justified, regardless of the situation. And also, violence... See, I'm Haida, and in our system, we were taught how to resolve conflict without conflict. How do you avoid causing the conflict to spread? People picking sides, who's right, who's wrong. Well, what I did was, in a way, I guess you might say I resolved the conflict without conflict, but with the threat of it is still mm-hmm. using conflict. But another way, I guess it just sort of shocked him that he hadn't realized he was behaving that way.
He probably nobody ever stood up to him in that manner.
It was the same thing. I used to go to Alcoholics Anonymous in Lethbridge, Alberta, and I went to one of the meetings, and there was a guy in there that was just cranky. He was a little bit older than most of the guys.
Wait, I've got to cut you off there. Does that mean we can't have a drink after this show?
Oh, yeah. What I do is when I go to the coffee shop downstairs, I told him I wanted medium coffee, medium roast, with one shot of whiskey. And they looked at me, and I, you know, like, what did you just say? I said, yeah, I want a shot of whiskey. And he just started laughing. I do that to people because they get in a rut. You know, they get...
And robotic.
Yeah. Yeah. And so by saying something like that, I haven't had a drink since 1981. Mm-hmm. But anyway, this guy was so cranky and crabby, everybody was scared of him. So I walked up to him and I started swearing at him. And I said, I wish you'd go out and get drunk. Said, you're on a dry drunk here and you're the most miserable sucker I've ever run into. You're terrifying everybody. So why don't you just go out and get drunk? And he stood there with his mouth hanging open, staring at me, and he said, am I like that? And all the guys said, yeah. You know, people will get into a pattern of behavior, and so sometimes you just need to turn on the light. And so that's what I try to do is if I can figure out a way, like, for example, I was driving on 3rd Avenue up by 3rd and Balsam. I was heading west, and I came to a stop sign. I drive a Saab 900 series, and it's built kind of low to the ground. Well, there's a stop sign, so I eased up to the intersection. I was trying to see if there's any traffic coming, and I heard this horn honking. I looked in my rearview mirror, and here's this big SUV. Well, my initial reaction was to get angry. And I thought, no, I'm going to do something different. So I put it in park. I opened my car door, and I didn't turn to my right, you know, toward the. Instead, I turned completely the other way. I turned to my left. So I'm turning out away from the car, which is non-threatening. The other is going to be confrontational. So I didn't even look at the driver. I walked looking at my car, looked at the back end of it, walked around examining, and I came back around. And I looked up, and the driver was a woman. And she was sitting there, white knuckles hanging onto the steering wheel. And I said, You obviously saw something wrong with my car and would bring my attention to it. Well, I've checked it out. Everything's okay, but thank you for your concern. Now, when I got my car and drove off, she must have thought I was a complete nut. You know? But it's things like that I've learned over the years. I walked in a bar when I was in the U.S. Navy. I was in uniform, and there were six Marines sitting there. And there's always this thing between sailors and Marines. And immediately they started making derogatory remarks. So I'd gone to boot camp in San Diego, and there was a Navy boot camp and a Marine, one called MCRD, which is a Marine Corps Recruit Depot. So I walked right over to their table, and I said, you know, those DIs, those drill instructors at MCRD in San Diego, I said, they're full of crap. I said, they're teaching you guys that it takes 10 sailors to whip one Marine. I said, I've not yet met a Marine that six of us couldn't whip. They started laughing. Come on, sit down and have a drink, you know. So there's ways in which you can show that you're not afraid without having to do the macho warrior stuff. So I found I could get away with almost anything like that, you know. Because I don't like getting lumps on my head. Because even if you win, you're still going to get bruises and lumps. So nobody really wins, you know. So anyway, so when I see things like that, I try to figure out how can I resolve this without starting war. And in Haida, we had one person who was the boss of the speaking. And this is the person who, like, was an MC at potlatches and feasts and this sort of thing. But also, if there was a conflict, this person would ensure that both sides had equal opportunity to express their views. And then sometimes there was a ceremony, and one of them was called Tlahal. Some call it a different name, but it's called a bone game. It's where you have two sticks, one's painted, one isn't, and they're concealed in your hand. And so the other side has to guess which hand that the one marked is in. And it said, if the spirit is with you, you'll be able to see through that other person's hand. And so there's songs that go with it. Hala hi ala, hala hi ala, hee, hala hi ala. That's one of the songs goes that way. Come on, hala hi, you know, bring it here, bring it here. And at the end of the game, somebody wins. But it doesn't matter which one won, because it means that the spirit has decided that the conflict is over. And so nobody picks sides. There's no people, well, this person is this person, whatever. No, it's settled. And that's one of the ways in which they settle conflict.
The spirits are at peace now.
Yeah.
Not about I was right, you were wrong.
Yeah.
But we're now at a peaceful level.
Yeah. See, the difficult for me is I went to law school. And in law school, everything has to be conflict. You know, you always have to prosecute your lawyer, your client's case. But you have to be able to do either side equally well. So it's not about right or wrong. It's what you call balancing the equities. Who's less wrong or who's more right? And so when you get back into the tribal system, so that's why I decided not to practice law. Instead, I just start teaching the Haida cultural ways of seeing the world rather than getting into that advocacy thing role. So there's so many ways in which, well, even counseling, we don't have answers for anybody. A person will come and ask me for advice. I'll never give it to them. Because if you ask for it, you have to take it. If you don't take it, you've insulted me. And if I offer it, I'm insulting you because I'm telling you I'm smarter than you and I know what's best for you. So instead of doing that, we use stories. My son might be having a problem with something. Hey, Pop, I'm running to this. I don't know what to do. So I'll tell them a story. And all of our stories are personal experience, either my own or the ones I've heard from people from many different places. One of the ones, I was visiting with a guy from West Africa. I forget which tribe it was. Anyway, he was telling me when he left to come to Canada, he was going to Manitoba University to get a degree, I guess, in technology transfer. And he said when I was leaving, he said the old man sat with me and told me, every once in a while, slow down and let your spirit catch up. Don't run away from your spirit. And so sometimes, like I was working with a person with PTSD, and I asked, is there always somebody chasing you in these nightmares? And she said, I hate those. I asked, do you know who's chasing you? And she said, no. And I told her, well, sometimes when you realize you're dreaming, you can actually change the outcome of that dream. But you can also confront the one chasing you and find out who it is. And I think, at least in my case, it's my spirit trying to catch up. And I'm fighting them off. So sometimes you have to sit still, clear your mind. Actually, we call it clean your mind in Haida. So you get rid of all anything that can adulterate whatever the message is going to be. So you hear these things from many different places. There was a man here at UBC in a program to get 50 PhDs and five or something like that with Native people. And we were talking about the concept of time. And he said, in the Maori language, the past is in front of me, I can see it. The future's behind me, I can't see it. I said, you know, it's the same in Haida. When I say, oh, I agree, that's not long time ago. It's way over there. I can see it from here. So with the past in front of me, I can see everything that's happened to us since we came into being as humans. The future's behind me. It's like I'm standing in a river, and whatever's coming downstream, I don't see it until it gets within my peripheral vision. And when it does, I have to deal with it right at that point because it'll never be there again. If it hits me in the face, that's a traumatic experience. If I do like the Western world says and put it behind me, it's going to hit me in the face again. So I got to let it go, see where it fits into my history. And so when you start looking at the world views expressed by these different tribal languages, most are very, very different. Whereas you get into, we'll say, Western Europe, they all have the same world view because they all have the same root to their language, which is Latin, your Romance languages. So they all see the world pretty much the same way. Whereas with your tribal languages, if I don't speak your language, I can't really understand what your world is all about. And one of the things that helped a great deal is that all indigenous languages have sign languages, and everybody can read each other's. So that's how people were able to communicate. But today we don't use that anymore, but all we do is we have these sort of vestigial memories, I guess you might call them. So we make manual gesticulations. We wave our arms, but we don't say anything. I was on the board of directors for this called Image Nation, which was a First Nations film festival. And one of our submissions was from a young filmmaker in Australia, Australian Aborigine. And I screened the film, and there was almost no dialogue in it at all. It was a group of old men, or a group of men, and one was quite a bit older than the others. And they were making what they called a number 7 boomerang. It's because it's shaped in an L shape. You know, you turn it one way, it looks like a 7, the other way is an L, but they call it number 7. And that one is used for bigger animals. When a kangaroo travels in a straight line away, they would throw it so it'd spin in a forward spinning motion. The thing would come up from behind them and hit them between the eyes, conk them from behind. And anyway, they went around a small tree and dug out to the roots, and the one root on it was exactly that L shape. So they cut down the tree, they started cutting it out, and this old man sat watching them. And every once in a while, one of them would glance at him, And I was wondering, what the heck is going on here? So I ran it again and again and again and again. And about the sixth or seventh time, I finally saw it. When a man would take a look at that old man, sometimes he might raise an eyebrow, maybe his thumb might twitch, but they're very subtle little movements. And then I finally figured out he was teaching them how to make that boomerang. So I talked to the filmmaker, and I said, that old man's teaching them to make a boomerang, isn't he? He said, oh, you saw it? And I said, yeah, because it was very, very subtle movements. He didn't say a word. And anybody watching might assume that they're using ESP. Well, there's that too, but he was using sign language. And when we look at language, that's why this program we call Language of Languages, it's more than just vocabulary and rules and this sort of thing. So are you a student here? What is your name? I forgot to ask.
Brian.
Brian.
Yeah.
And you're a student here?
No, I'm just a student of life.
Oh, that's a good idea. See, there's a difference between coming to knowledge and education. Education is product-driven. That's where when you get educated, they put a stamp on your forehead, says you're educated. But coming to knowledge is a lifelong process. So Western is product-driven, Indigenous is process-driven. So there's no point at which you learn more than any other time. But learning, when I was a kid, I would sit with the old man, well, there was a group of them. Dear boy, sit down. I'm gonna show you something. So they didn't teach us by telling us, but when they did tell us, they were, like I said, these personal experience things that they would talk about. And When a child would ask questions, that child would be isolated from the others, and it would give this child every scrap of information they could give that child until the child stopped asking questions. Then when a child stopped asking questions, they would leave him alone to digest it. And so this is the way the learning went on. It wasn't you sit in the classroom so many days of the year That's why you have to learn to use your peripheral vision. It's a way of seeing what's coming, but also it gives you a much wider view of the world. If you look straight ahead when you walk in a dark room, that's all you're going to see is a dark room. But if you turn your head slightly, enough light will get past you to where you can have an indication of where you're going. I think we're going to have to do a PSA or something, isn't it? We should do that. I'm going deaf listening to the sound of my own voice.
What you gonna play now?
Bobby, I don't know. But whatsoever I play, it's got to be funky.
The Soulship Enterprise. Saturdays at 7 p.m. CITR 101.9.
When you join Balloon Club, we guarantee that you will be able to make a balloon poodle within the first day.
Here at the UBC Ant Club, we just like to talk about ants and compare ant farms. It's really cool.
Paperclip Club is all about, well, paperclips mostly.
At Blah Club, you can blah blah, blah 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 blah.
Explosion!
There's only one club worth joining at UBC, and that's CITR 101.9 FM. We got free tickets to shows, whirly pops, professional help in all types of audio engineering, passes to festivals, crazy parties, live band, swag. All types of crazy people. Our programming manager rides a motorcycle. There's freestyle rapping, Nardwar the Human Serviette, the vinyl and record libraries, Discorder magazine, free studio recording, and it sure beats the hell out of Paperclip Club, which is a thing that I just made up because I work at
CITR.
So come check us out on the top floor of the Student Union building. We got all types of crazy shit for you to do. Or check us out online at www.citr.ca.
We
Do you enjoy these sounds? CITR is the home of amazing sounds. So listen to me always. 101.9. CITR.ca.
Canadians are being bought and sold. We can no longer ignore this reality. Each of the 27 million human trafficking victims around the globe has a unique story. 80% of victims are women. 50% are children. This is not only a global injustice, but a local reality. It is happening right now in my community. We are asking you to take action today. Visit endexploitation.com. Get informed and take action. British anti-slavery leader William Wilberforce once said, "Having heard all this, you may choose to look the other way, but you can never say again that you did not know. Only question now is what will you do?" Join us and help eliminate human slavery in Canada.
Well, we've wandered far across the world into many different ideas and thoughts. Here's a real short story. It's actually, the story is quite long. When I used to listen to old men tell the story, it could go on for days. And
would you eat in between?
Huh?
Would you at least be able to eat in between?
Oh, yeah. They always had breaks. The old man would be to see our stories all
sounds
have...
Sounds like a cricket match a little bit, test match.
Well, cricket, that's one thing I never could understand, you know, because if you're hurling a ball is one thing, hurling chunks, that's something else, I guess, but I never could figure out what they were doing. But anyway, in these stories, there's always a gap in there, and this gap is when you know the rules, you don't ask questions because that will be filled in another story. And when I was in law school, we had to do these moot court arguments. And we were arguing a real estate contract. My partner and I were granted strict forfeiture. In other words, people had to get out immediately on Christmas Eve. I mean, but anyway, one of the judges, or it was two of them, at least one of them was from the New Mexico Supreme Court down in Albuquerque, New Mexico. It's where I went to school. And he said, "Counselor, if you ever pull that stunt in my courtroom, I'll make sure you don't practice law in any jurisdiction in which I have something to say about it." And I was stunned. I didn't know what to say. And he said, "Don't play stupid with me." He said, "You know exactly what you did." He said, "Under the canons of ethics, you are required to prosecute your client's case zealously within the bounds of law. That's not what you did. You suckered this court into discussing your client's case." And when he said that, I knew exactly what I had done. And I decided right then, I will never go in the courtroom. I will never do this again. What I did was I went back to my storytelling techniques. And there's always a gap left specifically to be filled, but they didn't know the rules. So they would ask a question, and we'd get into a discussion about it. And so these old people, when they'd be telling these stories, like the old man might would be sitting in the house, and he'd call his wife, "Ja," you know, get her attention, and she'd come in with a tray of food. It was usually like sun-dried halibut, sun-dried salmon, boiled potatoes, hooligan grease, and these Sailor Boy pilot bread crackers. And so we'd have something, some tea, and then she'd take it away and the story would start again. And the stories never went longer than about 6 hours total with the breaks in between. Then we'd start again the next day. But this one here is a very short version of it. And this was written by a man named Robert Kogo. He grew up with the language and later went on to business school. Anyway, so this is his version of it. From time to time, you'll hear some Haida words. This one's called Raven Finds Water. Long ago, there was a great drought over the land, over Tlagai. There was no water anywhere. All the creeks, streams, Huntlai, were dried up. Someone had to do something about it. Raven, Yath, rose to the occasion and volunteered to look for water for Hunt. He knew the island spirit, Gwaish Hanwai, at Hazy Islands called Dekinu, had water, Hunt, but no one knew where it was. The water was well hidden. Yath started out for the island, Gwai, in his canoe, clue. His intention was steal the water, Hunt, from the island spirit, Gwaish Hanwai. When he had paddled about halfway out, a dense fog, Yanu, set in. He lost his bearings and waited for the fog to lift. The sun, Juyai, could not dispel the fog. Yath was wondering what to do when island spirit Gwaish Hanwai paddled up to him in his clue, his canoe. You should not be out here, he told Raven. There's nothing on the island, and you could be delayed by weather for a long time. There's no water, Hunt, out there, he told Yath. Don't be crazy, Kunangala. Turn back, Stithla. After the island spirit Gwaish Hanwai left him, Yath made a turn as if he was turning back, but not for long, as he headed for the island, using the dim outline of Juyai, the sun, for his bearings. Yath soon heard the surf, Luda, on the island. He came to a bit of sand beach, Tajaskatas, where the island spirit Gwaish Hanwai came down to meet him on the beach on the Chow Sali. He welcomed Raven Yath to share his home, his Na. Raven made believe that he was in fact very thirsty. Katu, the island spirit kept his water well hidden. Raven was tough and could stay on and find where the island spirit kept the water hidden. He kept a watchful waiting policy. He began to think up schemes to find the water. One day, island spirit Gwaish Hanwai was lying beside the fire, beside Tsanu, warming his back and fell asleep. Kada. While he was sleeping, Raven went to the rookery and gathered some bird guano, bird droppings. When he came back, spirit was still asleep, so Yath very carefully rubbed the guano on his spirit's garments. Gi andao. He woke spirit and told him he smelled very bad. He'd been gathering eggs. This is seagull and duck eggs. And assumed he got the guano on his garments this way. Raven told him over and over, take a bath. Hadangtla. Wash yourself. The spirit made preparations to bath. He got his water contained, Adu, ready, and started out. In the confusion, he'd forgotten that he told Raven there was no water. Raven was now spying on spirit to see where he went for water. Spirit went away from his home, and under overhanging cliff, Haiwas, covered with moss, Gigans, was the water. Raven now knew where the water was and made preparations to steal it. From island spirit, early in the morning, Sandlanstlu, he left the home very quietly, taking along a water basket, Kadu. He went to the water hole, had a long drink of water. He was very thirsty. He filled the water basket and his beak and took off, flying toward the mainland where there was a great drought. Raven sprayed the water all over the land, and in the sky it started to rain. The streams were running. Raven had saved the country. Now, that's a very, very short version of it. One version is that Raven stole the water from Puffin. Puffin is a seabird that flies very fast. And anyway, Raven drank his fill. He drank all the water, and then he took off, but he couldn't fly fast because he was so heavily weighed down. by the water. And Puffin discovered that Raven had stolen the water, so started chasing him. And Puffin's got and he was catching up with Raven, and Raven didn't want to have to face a confrontation, so start spitting the water out to lighten his load so he could fly faster. And wherever that water landed, there was lakes and ponds and streams, and Puffin was still gaining on him. And finally he spit out the last of the water from inside his stomach, and it landed on the north end of Haida Gwaii, and we call it Hadu, because the water was brown. It came out that way, and Puffin caught up with Raven and threw him to the ground and was pummeling him and hitting him. And Raven was saying, "Stop, stop." He said, "I'll give you something in return. I'm sorry I took your water. I'll give you something." "No, no, don't. Please don't hit me anymore." So Puffin said, "What are you going to give me to replace the water?" He said, "I'll give you fire." He said, "Where are you going to get fire?" And so he pointed out to the northwest, and to the northwest of Haida Gwaii was a volcano. It's long since sunk under the water, and it's now one of the most seismically active areas in the entire Pacific Rim. But anyway, he said, "Well, how are you going to get fire from it?" And he said, "I'll show you." So he let Raven get up, and Raven went over to a tree, and he broke off a branch and took some pitch from the tree and put it on both ends of the stick. And Hawk was a very good flyer and had a very long beak. So he told Hawk, he said, "You take this stick in your beak and you fly close to that volcano, and then when it catches fire, you turn real fast to roll over it so that you can fly the other way and light the other side." So Hawk took off with that stick in its beak, and he was circling that volcano, getting closer, and as he got closer, his beak began to soften, and it began to droop. And it was drooping down quite a bit, and all of a sudden that pitch ignited. And so Hawk did sort of a loop. And the G-forces, I guess, when he looped like that, bent the end of his beak straight back. So it's curved back. But he was close enough to where the other side caught fire. So Hawk came back with his stick burning on both ends. And Raven never even thanked him for it. He just grabbed it and he gave it to Puffin. He said, "Here's your fire." And Puffin said, he said, "I can't thank you enough." So Puffin put that stick in his mouth and he took off flying for home. And he's flying so fast that it caused that flame to burn real hot and very fast, and the flames were streaking back. And so by the time he got back to his island, it was almost burning his cheeks. So when you see a picture of Puffin, you'll see it has these orange streaks on one on each cheek going back from that fire. So that's one of the versions of... No, Hawk. If you see a carving of Hawk on a pole, his beak is bent backwards. You know, it drooped down and then backwards. So that comes from that story. But Hawk was really good. Well, Raven is actually one of the most acrobatic flyers you'll ever see. So anyway, we kind of wandered around the country, and I guess we got about a minute over. So anyway, so have a nice week, and I'm in the process of moving. I got evicted so they could do a renovation. So I got to be out there on the 31st. So anyway, I'll talk to you from my new digs next week.
I'm Marie Bernard, host of Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Join me Mondays at noon as we explore the universal energy that connects us all. Let's discuss our journey of self-discovery, joy, presence, and living with authenticity. We can create positive change in the world, and it starts within each one of us. Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Mondays at noon on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver. Mind, body.
Body and Soul. Thank you for being with me today. I'm so excited to speak with today's guest. Mary O'Malley is an author, professional speaker, and transformational life coach. She has over 30 years of experience living and teaching the art of being fully alive, and you can totally feel it in her book, What's in the Way is the Way, Moving Beyond Your Struggle into the Joy of Being Fully Alive. I've read this book cover to cover, and I've been jumping ahead, and I'm on my second reading now, so I'm so excited to speak with Mary. Welcome to the show, Mary.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here, Marie.